The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is brought to you by One-Click Upsell by Zipify Apps. You probably know there's three ways to make more money from your store. You can get more traffic, you can increase the size of the orders you get, or you can increase the number of people that convert on your site. You're probably spending time on traffic, almost certainly. You may have spent time with conversion rate optimization, but when's the last time, honestly, you tried to increase that cart size? Well, One-Click Upsell makes it incredibly easy to offer powerful targeted upsells to your customers. They've generated over $150 million in additional revenue for store owners, just like you. And over 16% of people who get offered an upsell actually take you up on it. It's really powerful. Their entire system is built into Shopify's native checkout, so it's rock solid and secure. And it's built by Ezra Firestone and his team. Ezra, you may know, good friend of mine. He's been in the e-commerce game for a long time. He uses this on his own eight-figure stores. He's in the trenches and he knows it works. So if you want to actually start working on a third of your business that you've been neglecting, increasing that cart size, check them out today at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. The E-Commerce Fuel Podcast is sponsored by Klaviyo, the leading e-commerce marketing solution for email and SMS trusted by over 50,000 merchants. Why? Because they have a pretty amazing segmentation and customization engine built in to their marketing platform. It lets you send messages based on what your customers have done, what pages they've visited, how much they've spent with you, how much they're likely to spend with you over time with their very cool LTV prediction tool, what products they've purchased or haven't purchased. It's pretty incredible. And in a world where email inboxes are only getting more crowded, people are getting more ruthless, sending highly targeted messages is the only way you're going to be able to cut through the noise. And you can do that with Klaviyo. So if you want to make more money from your flows, from your efforts on email and SMS, check them out. You can start for free at klaviyo.com/ECF. That's klaviyo.com/ECF. Hey guys, Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven-figure plus e-commerce brands build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And I'm guessing in most of our entrepreneurial careers, at one point or another, you've come across a business or an asset or something that was selling cheaply. And you thought, you know, I think there's some potential there. Give me 3 or 4 months with this business, and I think I could buy this for pennies on the dollar and turn it into something, you know, pretty valuable. The hard part is, maybe that's true sometimes. It certainly is true sometimes, but being able to have the judgment and wisdom to be able to discern the opportunities from the just nightmarish, soul-sucking, energy-destroying lemons can be tricky. And that's why I found this discussion today so fascinating. I'm joined by Brian Lazoon and Janine Doe, the couple who owns VirginiaBoysKitchens.com, a business that they bought that hadn't been profitable in 5 years. And they picked it up and dramatically increased, took it to profitability, to meaningful profitability, and grew the business with some pretty cool tactics. So we get into how they knew the business actually had potential. We talk about how price increases were material to their improving the business, how they were able to dramatically increase their margin through manufacturing and supply chain optimization. We get into the weeds about Amazon PPC and how they were able to take their advertising cost of sale, cut it more than half for margins, a bunch of stuff. It's a really cool case study on how to take something that's, you know, a real dog and turn it into a top performer. So I enjoyed it and hope you do too. Got a few welcomes I want to throw out there for some of our new community members in E-Commerce Fuel. This is our private community for 7 and 8 figure store owners. And big shout outs going to Rob Bramwell from bramwellbrown.com, Chad Ross from dorsalbracelets.com, Mike Hutzel from EagleOneGroup.com, Nabil Rab from AltaNew.com, Jason Richardson from BadBirdieGolf.com, and Jack Carrier from Dog Tag Art. Real pleasure to meet all of you. The new member call recently, put some faces and websites to names, and great to have you in the community. And if you enjoy the conversation that I'm about ready to have with Brian and Janine, and if you know if you're running in the trenches, a meaningful 7 or 8 figure e-commerce brand, I think you'll like what you find inside. Come check us out, learn what the tribe is about, and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Before diving in, one thing I got to mention I'm excited about. We are hiring a full-time director of events for the E-Commerce Fuel private community. Looking for a seasoned event planning pro to help get all of our wonderful members together, kind of coming out of COVID, as that's hopefully right around the corner. Yeah, it's a lot of perks with the role, a lot of freedom and flexibility to get very fun and creative and put together unique events, lots of fun travel. Whoever is in the position is going to have a 1 month sabbatical every single summer. And of course, all the standard retirement matching, retirement plan, insurance stipend, competitive salary, et cetera. So if that is you, if you happen to have a bunch of event experience or you know someone who's gifted in the event space, please check it out or let them know about it. You can learn more about the position, how to apply at ecommercefuel.com/director of events. And the deadline for applying is April 11th. All right, let's jump into it. Janine and Brian, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, excited to dive into this. Brian, you posted a great case study in the forum, which made me read it and say, hey, I got to get these guys on to talk about this. This is very cool. And I figured a good place to start was you wrote, and I can't remember if this was in the case study or a different interview I was looking at with you guys, but you said we're able to pay for these businesses for pennies on the dollar. And obviously the business that you guys purchased, you know, it was, I don't know if distressed is the right term, but that's the term I'm going to use, hadn't been profitable in 5 years. And you know, you were able to get a great deal on it. But at the same time, it's tricky to, you know, it can be hard to differentiate a distressed business, one where there's value and one that's just a bad bet. So when you guys, the business you ended up buying was VirginiaBoysKitchen.com, which I mentioned at the top of the episode, what specifically were you guys looking for? And what did you see in the business that you know, made you decide to pull the trigger?
Yeah, so we had just come off, we just exited our previous e-commerce brand. And it was a brand that we had built over the past 2-3 years. And it was pretty much 100% an Amazon FBA business. And when we finally closed that sale, which was like mid-March of 2020, we had already kind of started a new e-commerce brand that we were, again, launched directly on Amazon FBA, but we were looking for something else to buy. And we didn't really know quite what we wanted at that point, but I think Janine had sent out an email to Joe Bally at Quiet Life Brokerage. That's who we closed our previous deal on. And she just pretty much said, hey, we're in the market. We're looking for, you know, a business that we could, you know, comfortably pay cash for. So I think the original thing was, you know, something in the few $100,000 range, like nothing above that. And he sent us back an email, and I just looked at it this morning just to kind of remind myself of dates and stuff like that. And he said, well, I've got one that we're getting ready to list. It has bad margins, overblown ad spend, and decreasing revenue. He says, I don't think it's a fit for you, but take a look. And we're like, yeah, we're like, oh, that sounds great. So we got the information. We looked at it. We mulled over it. Not very long. There were things about the business that we had thought, aside from the economics of the business, just looked awesome. I mean, the branding was really well done. It had a good history. It was doing great revenue. So I think at its peak, it was close to $2 million in revenue. And the asking price, I don't think they had kind of pinned down an asking price at that point, but it was going to be, you know, under $50,000. Like, something's crazy. We need to dig into this kind of deeper. And we did. And like I was saying, there were things that this business did that we hadn't been able to, I guess not been able to, but that we didn't do before in the other business because it was strictly FBA. This one is kind of going, it was a lot of Amazon, but it started to become a really powerful brand. And it was in a space that we got excited about. It was in the kitchen space. It was made in USA products. It was kind of very different for us. We just got excited about the opportunity that brand kind of presented itself.
Yeah. And I'm looking at it now, and it's got, and obviously you have, how long have you owned the business for?
10 months.
Okay. So looking at it now, and it's got a lot of, you know, like I mentioned at the top, just really kind of high quality kitchen goods, cutting boards, knives, things like that. Did a lot of this creative that you saw, how much of it was already there? You talk about branding. Was that part of the branding and the assets that you looked at and saw the value in? Was good creative, a great product line that was built out? Is that kind of what you're referring to? Because it looks, I mean, looking at it right now, it looks beautiful.
Yeah, for sure. So a lot of the creative was done. I mean, we're still to this day finding photo shoots that they had that they had put together and done, and we're like, wow, we never saw this photo before. And so they did a really, really good job on that. So the, you know, they spent a lot of time on creative and growth and
yeah, things that Brian and I would never do, things that we're not good at, it's already there. So what we really like about this brand when we first looked at it was also the fact that all the things that we're not good at doing or have no experience doing, so photo shoots, videos, creative, branding, website design, all of that was very, very strong. And where it's weak was things that Brian and I are good at. You know, the second I saw Joe Valley mentioned it has overblown ad spend, I got really excited because with Amazon advertising, I know I can go in there and make it better for the most part.
Let's talk about margins a little bit because you mentioned at the top the margins were really, really low. And for me, like when, you know, looking at businesses, one of the first things I look at is a margin, like higher margins just, I mean, just opens up the world to you in terms of, you know, how much you can spend to get a customer, you know, sales, all this kind of stuff. It's really, I've run lean margin businesses in the past and it is tough. What for you guys ended up getting a new manufacturer, I believe, right? Like you down the road, and we can get into that in a few minutes, but I don't necessarily, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think you guys necessarily knew that was going to be, you could materially improve the margins. Or maybe you did. What was it that made you look at those margins and say, hey, this isn't a deal breaker? Because I think for a lot of people, myself included, that would really scare me away.
Yeah. So when we were looking and digging in and talking to the previous owner, what was, I guess, in hindsight, looking back, he had done a really extensive search to decrease his cost of goods. And he had thought that he had found a manufacturer in Canada that was going to cut the cost by 25-30%. And so we were excited that, you know, he had kind of explored that. But we also, we thought we were pretty good in the sourcing realm. So we originally, when we looked at it, we thought, yeah, we can definitely do better than this. Not only did we feel like he was paying too much for some of the products, but we felt that he didn't quite have his pricing right either. We were very confident we could fix it. But when we took over the business, we started realizing that it wasn't going to be as easy to fix those things as that we had kind of got a little overconfident with. The Canada manufacturer never panned out into what he had actually kind of led us to believe was going to happen. Like it required a pretty significant capital expenditures in, you know, buying equipment and putting them in this factory, and then with shipping costs and everything, the numbers started not looking as advertised, in other words.
And so what was it, and we'll jump ahead here maybe, you know, what was it, you get into the business and you buy it, and I think one of the first things you guys did was look at, or one of the major things at least, was improve the quality of the product. You mentioned that your customers, that you found out that one of the big problems was that the cutting boards, they kind of have a very fuzzy top grain to them. They were kind of made by someone who didn't specialize necessarily in kitchenware, but in other wood products. And you realize that, you know, kind of after a while, the top grain would get all fuzzy and it wasn't holding up as well as you'd hope. Did you guys how did you find that out? Was it just through reading reviews on your website? Did you send out a survey after you bought the business saying like, hey, we've got new owners, we want to make these products better? How did you, because that's a huge revelation, of course, a super important one that helped you guys pivot and make the product better and improve the business. But how did you find out about that?
Yeah, so that's actually what ended up leading to much better COGS, much better product. So we did all of our own customer service. So we took over the brand. That was one of the first things that we did was kind of transition away from the customer service rep that they were using and took it all in-house, which was basically us, you know. So it was either Janine or I answering all of these reviews and emails and return requests. And there was a very common theme around everything. And some of it, we were led to believe that it was maybe user error more than anything else. So these are wood cutting boards, so they do require a little bit more care than, you know, a plastic or glass or marble. So they, getting them overexposed to water and not seasoning them with the proper oils can cause, you know, some of the swelling in the wood grains to raise up, which causes like a rough kind of fuzzy feeling. So we had conversations back and forth with customers, back and forth with our manufacturer, and we truly started almost feeling like it might not be fixable. So we started looking into the root of well, maybe we can provide, you know, better care instructions and even, you know, provide a care kit so that these boards can be sanded down by the customer. And it was all stuff that we thought was, you know, made sense at the time. And then as we started kind of reading the words that we were sending back as suggestions to customers, it was, we started saying, you know, would this be something that we would be comfortable with? Would we spend, you know, $100, $150 on a cutting board and then have to take it out into the garage and kind of make it a woodshop project? And we realized, no, that's not.
What you need is your own customized humidifier for your cutting board, which only costs $250. We'd be happy to sell it to you.
Yeah. So Janine had sent some inquiries out to some other wood manufacturers. The other hard part was we were trying to really stick with the Made in the USA brand. We felt like that was a big part of what the brand stood for. So we weren't going to source anywhere but the US, and we were really committed to doing that. And just through, you know, getting samples and talking to people, and we started getting products that were, you know, either significantly better or noticeably better, and then started negotiating on costs. And we, you know, met a factory, and we, you know, met them personally, went down there, saw their process, and we literally in this, you know, fixed both things at once. So we fixed our cogs significantly, and we have a much better product after it.
Yeah. And so we ended up visiting, we had visited the previous factory. That was one of the first thing we did. You know, this was like during COVID. We literally drove 14 hours just to like go visit them. It was pretty fun. They're in Ohio in the middle of Amish country. We had a really good time. But what I'd also realized when we were there is not only do they not deal with walnut wood all that much, but their specialty was more about staircases, stair steps, and like these major industrial products that probably get sealed and finished a different way than a cutting board would. You know, a cutting board, it's meant to be wet. It's meant to get wet. It's meant to be chopped on and pounded on very differently than, you know, a set of staircase. But with the new manufacturer, like I think one of the main things that they did and pre-COVID, it was plaques for like awards and stuff like that. So literally they are very used to creating a square piece of wood because that was a big part of their business. But, you know, with COVID, all of a sudden, you know, people aren't having events and sports and, you know, there's no more plaques. So they were looking for business. And not only that, but walnut wood was like a large part of their business. So they know the wood really, really well.
Interesting. So much better fit on the manufacturer side. How hard was it finding this manufacturer? Because I only have a tiny little bit of experience in this, but you know, in the past I've tried to source something. Granted, it was a soft good in the US, and it was just I was able to find a handful of manufacturers, but trying to connect with them and get it done, even connect with some of them and get people on the phone was a little tricky. And the ones that I did, the price point was just, there's no way it was going to work. How was it? And obviously, you know, it's going to vary niche by niche, depending on what you're having made or built, but how hard was it for you guys? Is there a lot of options? Would you say it was easier or harder to find a replacement factory in the USA versus what you were expecting?
Yeah, much harder. So not only is finding them harder, but working with them, finding the ones that will work with, you know, I guess what we would consider a smaller brand. There's no Alibaba for United States, I guess. So, and we had only previously sourced from China. So we got really comfortable with that process. And we found that not only like sourcing in China, it's become very easy. I mean, maybe too easy in a sense, but they're not only are they easy to get in touch with, but they're willing to pretty much do anything that you ask of them. Whereas we found US manufacturers, you know, they're very set in their ways. They don't have a lot of sway for customization. Their, you know, MOQs are much higher, and they're looking, I think, for a bigger companies to deal with.
You know, let's take pricing and maybe any kind of ethical questions people would have. Ethical is the wrong word. Any kind of considerations for, you know, making domestically, but just from a pure convenience factor. You guys have done both. You've sourced in Asia, you've sourced in the USA. And I think a lot of times some of the narrative around the USA sourcing, and I would tend to believe it's probably true, but don't know because I haven't sourced anything through the US, is you've got, you know, there's no language barrier or much less of one. You know, hours are the same. It's, you know, transit times are less. All these kind of things from just being proximate, being in the same nation, the same culture, all that kind of stuff. Have you found how much more convenient is it just on that front to be able to source from a domestic manufacturer? And does it offset in your minds, you know, probably that what I'm guessing is you're gonna be paying more for it. Has it been a good trade, and what's the convenience factor been like?
Yeah, definitely a good trade-off. One of the things we enjoy is being able to actually have a relationship with them. So, I mean, we've got to meet them. We've got to see the factories. We've got to see how things are done. We've got to, you know, go out for drinks and dinner with them. So it's, you get to know them more on a personal basis. So you kind of feel like they're, you know, more part of your business than when you're dealing with, you know, the Chinese manufacturers. We also like, obviously, lead times are much better. You don't have to deal with, you know, trying to order something 90 days in advance, and forecasting becomes, you know, a little bit easier. This past year has been challenging because of staffing and shortages with COVID. So some of the factories in the US seem to have been hit harder than at least the ones we've dealt with in China. So they, you know, if they're operating at 50% capacity, obviously things slow down quite a bit, but we've kind of weathered that storm. We really enjoy it, but it is a lot harder. There's definitely not the same amount of options and opportunity.
Yeah. Janine, maybe you can speak to how much, obviously from your side, it's convenient on a logistics standpoint, relation standpoint. From your customer standpoint, I think a lot of people, when they sell something that's made in the USA, you know, obviously try to highlight that, mention that. And there's definitely a lot of customers to who that's really important. But in your experience, have you found like what percentage of your customers, and you can't tell perfectly, of course, but just through talking on the phone with the customer service experience you had, hearing from people, reviews, those kind of things, like how big of a deal is that to people? How much of a selling point is that to customers as far as you can kind of discern?
I think it's, you know, there's a trend right now towards made in USA. And I think that's definitely an area that's growing, you know, with COVID that actually became even more of a thing. I think at first, a lot of people were like, oh, I don't want anything from China because it might be COVID on there. So having a package arrive to your door that says made in USA. And on top of that, we are also sustainable. We use sustainable walnut wood. We plant one tree for every cutting board that's sold. And we say this everywhere on our website, through our email flows. And we really, you know, really pound it hard in there that, hey, listen, we have a mission. This is what we stand for. We are in this country. Our customer service is not outsourced. We live here. We're local. You know, everything is made with organic ingredients. Obviously, we wouldn't know unless we split test whether or not that helps with conversion on our site. However, we have had a lot of customers out of the blue just reaching out to us and telling us how much they love our mission. And a lot of them, even in their reviews, would mention, oh, I bought this brand. I paid a little bit more money for it, but that's okay because I like what they stand for. Like, we get that a lot from customers through reviews or emails.
So what, end of the day, what was the margin bump you saw by going to the new manufacturer? And if you're comfortable sharing margins, great. If not, rather, you know, maybe we were able to increase our margin by 50%, double it, whatever that was. How much of an impact did it make?
Made a huge impact. So we definitely were able to pretty much across the board cut COGS by about 25 to 30%. And at the same time, before we had actually cut COGS, we had raised prices across the board by almost that same 25 to 30%. And at the time of raising the prices, we didn't see any dip in sales. It gave us, so that sort of started to fix the margin problem, just that alone. And then when we were able to cut costs, it really
just
made
crazy.
Things better. Yeah. It allowed us to do a lot more with, you know, sales and promotions, and, you know, we could, at the beginning, if we offered, you know, 10, 15% off, it was really taking away any profit that we might have. And so it limited what we could do in terms of giveaways and promotions. This just changed everything.
Yeah. Talk about the price increase a little bit, because I feel like in my business career, some of the, if not the most impactful things I have ever done across multiple businesses has been rolling out price increases. And it's It's always terrifying when you do it. I always push it off way longer than I should. And I always wonder about 2 weeks or a month after the fact, why in the world didn't I do this, you know, 12 months earlier? And obviously you guys came in, you had a fresh business. And so you jumped on it much faster, but yeah, just the power of it. It's always impressed me. Were you guys pretty tentative about doing that? Or was it pretty right out of the gates? You thought, hey, this is something we should test out. And it was a no brainer.
Yeah, no, we did it pretty much right out of the gate. And I think we got comfortable with that. So with our previous brand, as we tested increasing prices all the time, and we never saw the decrease that we were always scared that we were going to see. So, and I think especially with this brand, we kind of knew we had a premium product in the marketplace. There weren't a lot of competition that were strictly made in USA. There's not a lot of people using walnut wood. So we knew that if we marketed it correctly, that we could definitely raise the prices. And I don't remember exactly when we did it, but I'd be surprised if it was more than a month into taking over.
Yeah, well, good work. Obviously the right call. Janine, talk a little bit, if you would, about Amazon PPC. You got, you just kind of lit up talking about that earlier. That sounds like your area of expertise. And I think you mentioned that you got your Amazon average cost of sale from 55% down to 25%. Is that right?
Yes. So, you know, I think I'm very lucky in the sense that I started from scratch an Amazon brand back when advertising on Amazon was pretty simple. So this was 2016, 2017. You know, back then there was no product targeting, there was no video ads, very little product display ad, very little headline search ad, which today I guess it's called sponsored brands ad. So back then it was just literally keywords, you know, it's broad phrase, exact, and keywords. There was no placement adjustment, there was no product page adjustment. Everything was pretty simple. So I was in Amazon at the time when advertising was pretty simple. So, you know, I took a few courses. I had a very good mentor for FBA. I was in a mastermind. So he had this PPC instructions on what to do with a automation software. So, and, you know, so I was doing advertising right when it was very simple and I was able to get it to numbers that I really love, you know, 25% ACOS with my previous brand. And as Amazon comes out with new things slowly over time, I try every single thing that they would have. So over time, I was able to grow with the Amazon advertising. I get to play around with different advertising types and learn how to optimize them over the years. So when we took over this brand, one of the first thing I did was went to his backend in his Amazon account. Like this was before we bought it. I wanted to go in there and look. Yeah, and I was really excited because he spent a lot of money on Amazon ads, which means there's a lot of data for me to look at and optimize and download. I don't have to worry about, you know, spending a lot of money to buy data. It was already there. And I think it was like $1 million worth of advertised spend over 5 years. So I was really excited about that. And I saw the ACOS and I just knew I could make it better. He had tried doing it on his own. He had tried with an agency. I can tell from the way they name things, which agency it was too. And, you know, a lot of the things that I would have done wasn't done yet. A lot of things I would have optimized wasn't there. So I saw a significant amount of opportunity in advertising with this brand. At the low margin that this owner was having with his products, he was literally losing money for every sale that he made. So when we first took over, you know, while Brian was busy looking at Cox and dealing with customer service, I spent the first 3 weeks, 8 hours a day, 40 hours a week, literally doing absolutely nothing except PPC. And I had so much fun. I was in there all day long, downloading all kinds of data that was available. I have my own little system. I use PPC Entourage. It's like $50 a month. It's awesome. I highly recommend it.
So you really dove deep on that front. What were the PPC Entourage? We'll link up to that. Obviously you did a lot. You were, you know, knee deep in that for 2 or 3 weeks. What was the biggest or the 1 to 2 biggest things that you did to get that, you know, to cut that ACOS average cost of sale down by, you know, more than half. What were the biggest levers that you pulled to improve the profitability of those campaigns?
So I think negative keyword is big. And I don't think it gets talked enough in the PPC world. So especially when you run, like, say, a broad campaign or a phrase campaign, you got to look at the search terms and strip out the fat. You know, literally, it's death by a thousand cuts. So, you know, for example, if you are advertising for the keyword, you know, garlic press, and someone types in black handle garlic press, and you have a white one, you better know to go in there and negative exact black handle garlic press, and also negative phrase the word black handle. So, you know, this brand did not have much negative keyword, doesn't have a lot of negative keyword, like, at all. When I was looking in all the campaigns, that was one part where I was really excited about, because there was literally not that many negative keywords. So after 3 weeks or so, I literally took out about 600 to 700 negative keywords, and I put in every single campaign.
Wow. What? You mentioned something that I thought was fascinating. You were saying that the previous owner was running the business and losing money on AdWords for the previous 5 years. And I think, you know, by extension, probably not doing great, probably losing money on the whole business for 5 years. How, and obviously you weren't there, and I'm not sure what kind of rapport you built with the seller, but do you understand why they did this for so long? Like, what was the thought process behind running a business at that, you know, at a drain for 5 years? You can understand for, you know, maybe 12, 18 months trying to get something ramped up, but this seemed like, what was going through? Why did they do that? Do you have any insight into that? It just surprises me.
Yeah. So we had a really good relationship with him at the time and still, and he's really, really smart guy. And looking back at things, it's hard to kind of understand why, or I guess how someone would do it for that long, but kind of the way he explained it. And I think he got a better grasp on it towards, you know, unfortunately, when he started looking to sell, he just became very focused on growth. And the, you know, kind of what he says is, if he had kind of stopped at around maybe the $500,000 mark in revenue and kind of looked at the economics of the business and kind of try to fix things then, he would have been in much better shape. But he said he just kept, you know, spending money on ads, using agencies. He kind of got really almost obsessed on the growth, the revenue numbers. And by the time I think he had either realized this or decided that he needed to fix it, the company had built up a lot of debt, cash flow was negative, sourcing things became very difficult. So when we took over, a lot of the ads had been, you know, turned off, a lot of things weren't replenished, and it just, the cash flow of the business started finally kind of, you know, strangling his ability to continue going. So it obviously, in those situations, that benefited us a lot. Looking at what he did, I mean, it's really hard to say, like, oh, he was reckless, he didn't know what he was doing, because he's a very, very smart guy. And I think, like, if he were to do it again, he would know what to do this time. But I think a lot of business owners get really, really overly focused on revenue instead of profit. And we had kind of always run our businesses profit first. And I'd owned brick and mortar businesses in the past, and you can't run those unless you're making a profit. You know, so I mean, you're out of business really quick. You know, you can't pay your lease and you can't pay your employees and you're done. And so we had always kind of had the profit first mindset, and we knew any business that we would run that would, you know, we're okay with slowing down growth as long as we're making money from every single sale. And so we did turn off a lot of sales channels that weren't profitable. We turned off ads that weren't profitable, and we were willing to kind of scale back to start over. But fortunately, we didn't lose a ton of revenue in the process.
It actually grew.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, Andrew here with a little aside. If you're listening, you're obviously interested in e-commerce. And so I want to make sure you know about our private community for 7- and 8-figure e-commerce brands at E-Commerce Fuel. And the secret sauce, like you might guess, is it's limited to people who own stores, who are in the trenches, practitioners doing this stuff. It's a very curated community, which has three big benefits. First, it means everyone inside can help get fast on-point answers to your most important questions. If you're trying to decide if SMS is a tool worth rolling out, if you just got suspended on Amazon, if you're trying to hire a director of e-commerce, these are all things that either people have experience with or have gone through in the forums. And if you post and ask questions, you'll get answers within hours, sometimes even minutes, as well as being able to tap into close to a decade of archive discussions. So you get a lot of insights, fast answers to pressing questions. You get to plug into an amazing network of over 1,100 experienced e-commerce entrepreneurs. So you can reach out to people if you're in e-commerce fuel. Our members are incredibly giving and generous. And so if you want to reach out to someone with expertise, oftentimes we'd be happy to share what they know. If you're, you know, traveling, hopefully when traveling is a common thing again, a lot of our members would hit in the city, you know, DC, Dallas, Sydney, Australia, you know, London, wherever it is, and be able to have someone on the ground you can connect with or maybe grab a beer with. It's an amazing network. And then finally, we've got a huge user-generated review library with over 10,000 reviews on agencies, software, e-commerce software that you can tap into to avoid costly hiring and software mistakes. Nothing is worse than spending 3 months with an agency to onboard only to find out that a bunch of people already tried them and they were horrible and they wasted a bunch of your money and your life. So those are the kind of things you can avoid tapping into the unbiased reviews and experiences of our members with our software directory. So if any of this sounds interesting to you, you should join us. ecommercefuel.com. You can learn more. You can apply for membership there. We also have a 5x ROI guarantee. If you own a 7 or 8 figure brand and your membership fees for our community don't pay for themselves at least 5 times over the course of the first year, we'll refund it completely as well as send you $1,000 just for the wasted time. So ecommercefuel.com, check it out. We'd love to have you apply and potentially join the community. All right, back to the discussion. And it seems like, I mean, obviously it's unfortunate for him and or her, whoever the owner was, but for you guys, I mean, the things that attracted you to the brand, customer base, great creative. Janine, you were talking about just treasure trove of lots of historical ad data. Those were all assets that at first blush, you know, you look at the declining revenue and that's, you know, not great, but you get all of those assets. You wouldn't have all those assets if he hadn't done that. So, I mean, in the future, I'm safe to say that you're probably going to look for a similar profile business, one where maybe it was managed with an eye way more towards growth that became unsustainable, but you've got all these kind of nice halo effects that you can use to come back in and kind of pivot the business to profitability.
Yeah, for sure. And the decreasing revenue, I don't think was due to anything except for turning off ads that were no longer affordable. So it wasn't like anything major happened in the business. Like we were very used to the Amazon world where, you know, the suspensions or ranking algorithms change things and sales drop overnight type of thing. It wasn't anything like that. So there was fundamentally the business was pretty sound. So the revenue decreases were, I guess, intentional, you could say.
Yeah. You mentioned, or Janine, maybe you mentioned that you turned off most of the Google ads. Janine, maybe you can you talk a little bit about like why, what was it? Obviously, Amazon ads were working great. Google ads, not so much, it sounds like. If you could talk a little bit about that and why you think they didn't work so well.
Well, I think by the time we took over, the previous owner had already turned off the Google ads. So one of the things that I also did was, you know, I'm going in there and once again, there's this treasure trove of 2 years worth of advertising data in there. Only thing is, I don't know Google ads the same way I know Amazon ads. So I, you know, I'm not very proficient in that area. I went through all the campaigns, all of the ad groups, trying to find something that could work that I could just turn on, you know, didn't really see anything there. We kind of shifted our focus more towards Amazon at first. But, you know, now just recently we started looking at Google ads again. And, you know, I just realized the way it was set up, he had an agency do it. And I don't know when this happened, but there was actually 2 sets of conversions that's being counted. So when we first took over the brand, we knew Google ads, the data didn't look right. It was saying we had a lot more sales than our Shopify site was telling us. So we were so confused about the data. So we were like, all right, you know what? We don't know this. We're not going to touch it. So that was our attitude at first. So now that we've revisited it, we realize, you know, there are 2 sets of conversion in there. So everything is being counted twice. Most of the ROAS is less than 1. The only ROAS that were good were on branded campaigns. which I don't love. I actually don't do any branded campaigns on Amazon or off Amazon. I don't believe in them. But, you know, there was one shopping ad that looked like it was doing decent. So we recently turned that back on about 5 or 6 months ago. You know, not a ton of money there. We spend like 100, 150 per day, but everything else is still off.
Talk a little bit about branded campaigns. And again, my background is not in paid search. I know very little, so I'm kind of, you know, treading dangerously outside of my area of competence here. But I have never, I've always been a little confused by them as well, because if somebody's searching in, if they're searching for your brand, for Virginia Boys Kitchens, obviously they know about you, they're interested in you, they're probably going to be able to come to you. And so why bid on your name when they're already searching for it? Granted, maybe a competitor can maybe, I don't know, potentially sneak in there and get you. But I usually am smart enough, or at least think through enough, to, if I search for them, I'll scroll down to the organic listings. Is that kind of your same thought process? Why do you not like branded campaigns?
Yeah. So for the same reason that you just mentioned, you know, someone searching for you and they don't buy you, they see somebody else, you might lose a few sales here and there. But I feel like, so with regular campaigns that are keyword driven, especially say in Amazon, if I didn't negative exact my brand, and if I didn't negative phrase my own brand, when I look at a campaign at a top level, I might see, oh, that this campaign has a 20% ACOS. Oh, it's freaking awesome. So I wouldn't focus on it. I would go and look at something that's not doing great to try and optimize it. Now, it's just so happened that sometimes that 20% ACOS campaign, if you dig a little deeper, you would realize, no, it's actually doing really bad. It's just that people, that keyword just happened to show up for your brand. So it's converting really, really good. But that campaign needs a lot of work. But now I don't see that at the top level. I shift my focus to other ones. So I call that like skewing my data. It messes up my data. And that's what I don't like.
Could you talk through that a little bit more? Because I don't think I'm not sharp enough to follow you on the fly there. I missed that. How can you give us an example of how a campaign with a branded search that's somewhat related to branded search could have such a great performance, you know, a 20% average cost of sale, but still not be, can you talk through that a little bit more?
Sure. So let's say you advertise, you do a broad match, you advertise for the keyword garlic press. And then, so now you would still show up for your brand. So let's say cutting board. So I would still show up for the keyword Virginia Boys Kitchens cutting board or Virginia Boys cutting board. So when I look at my Amazon campaign at a top level, you know, at the campaign, it says 20%. That looks great. But now you dig in, you realize most of the sales come from the search term Virginia Boys Kitchen cutting board.
I see. So if you don't do a negative modifier for your brand name, it looks like that cutting board is doing really well, but really it's just the name of the keyword plus your brand. And it's your brand that's driving most of the performance, not the keyword.
Correct. Yep. So I wouldn't know that, hey, maybe this keyword needs a little work. For example, when I first took over, the keyword cutting board was showing up for a lot of things that are not relevant to our brand. For example, acacia cutting board, plastic cutting board, bamboo cutting board, glass cutting board, personalized cutting board, all those things needs to be taken out via negative phrasing them. If the brand keyword had been in there, and I just briefly look at it, I would totally have missed the fact that, hey, this keyword needs a little work.
Yeah. What was the tool? Obviously, you've gone super deep on this. You mentioned a tool earlier about PPC. One I hasn't, Amazon PPC, one I'm not familiar with. Could you talk a little bit about that and what some of the features or functionality that you really appreciate in that tool are?
So it's PPC Entourage. I know their pricing model may have recently changed, but it used to be on a SKU by SKU basis. So that's how they price things. And I prefer that a lot better than PPC softwares that charge you based on how much you spend. I think that's ridiculous. But their automation, I really, really love. So, you know, they would bid up or bid down based on a target ACOS that you would set. So I don't need to go there and do it manually. You can turn ads off at certain times of the day. Sometimes I would turn it off at midnight, you know, when I feel like people are on there because they're bored and browsing at 3 a.m. No one's looking to buy anything. And the ability to bulk update, like you can go in there and tell it, hey, look at this SKU and look at every single one of my campaigns that has this SKU in it and tell me what search terms are profitable. And then I would take all of those search terms and make them into a keyword. And but at the same time, I can also go in there and tell it, hey, for this particular SKU and every single campaign that has a SKU, what search term is bad for it? So now I'm seeing all the, you know, acacia cutting board, plastic bamboo cutting board. So now just with one click, I'm able to see all the keywords, all the search term, excuse me, that's it's showing up for, that's unprofitable. And I can just select all, tell the software to negative exact those keywords, and then I'm good.
Interesting. Cool. I'm going to have to dive into that a little bit more. You had mentioned, Brian, I think in your case study or somewhere else, that your guys' plan was originally to try to grow the Amazon side of the business. But I think you mentioned that the Shopify side has grown more than you expected, which is surprising because I think usually people have the opposite problem. They have the problem that, you know, Amazon's taken off like a rocket and they want to grow their .com, but they're struggling to do that. So could you guys talk a little bit about that? Like what was it that, I think a lot of people would love to have that problem and they don't. So how did that work out?
Yeah, so we definitely went into it thinking, oh, we know Amazon. So that's going to be the natural thing that we felt confident that we could do. But we also had Shopify store envy, I guess. So we had belonged to a few different masterminds. I think the one that we were most involved in was Blue Ribbon Mastermind with Ezra Firestone. And everybody's talking about, you know, these Shopify things and Klaviyo flows and things that we weren't really doing in our other business. So even though we wanted, or we thought it would be more natural to grow the Amazon side, we got more excited about growing the Shopify side. And I think our focus pretty quickly changed to that side of the business. And as the more we dug in, we felt that we could actually increase revenue there a lot easier than what was happening on Amazon. And I think a big part of it was turning on some really good email flows through Klaviyo that weren't really being done before. So a lot of the flows that have been set up in the past were a lot of transactional type of flows, not a lot of promotional. And Janine really got really involved into that. And that's when we started getting a lot of, you know, repeat sales, and we could, you know, do a promotion and get instant results from it and kind of build from there. We also started using, I think Janine can probably talk about this, but we're trying to get the data from Amazon. So there's data we can pull to try to get Amazon shoppers' contact information so that we could start putting them into our flows and kind of pulling them over to Shopify.
So, you know, you've gone through this whole process. It's been, you said 10 months since you guys closed on the deal. Is that right?
Yep.
10 months. Okay. And obviously profitability is hard because the company wasn't making money, but from a revenue standpoint, how much have you guys seen revenue increase since you closed the deal and revenue growing profitably as well?
I pulled some numbers last night and I was looking at them. So on the Amazon side, you know, for the trailing 12 months with the previous owner on Amazon, it was 1.2 million and Shopify was about 165,000. So that's around Shopify being 12% of total sales. For the 10 months since we took over, and you know, I'm extrapolating data and adding 2 months, so the numbers for simplicity. So since we took over, Amazon is at 1.3 million and Shopify grew 80% to 296,000. So now that accounts for 18% of total sales. We also increased customer return rate from 9% to 16%. You know, I would attribute that mostly to having a very robust Klaviyo email flow.
That's all. And I mean, the biggest thing there is the revenue looks, you know, the revenue trends are great, but even more importantly is you guys are actually making money off that revenue now, which is the big part, right? So, well, that's great. Congratulations. And one last thing I want to touch on is I know you guys came in and kind of ruthlessly slashed a lot of SaaS spending, apps. I know sometimes, you know, people can experience death by app on Shopify. And I think that was maybe the case for you guys. But you did have some apps that you found. I love your guys' approach. You guys seem hyper-focused on, is this helping us generate revenue or not? A lot of Shopify apps got the axe, but you had a handful that you really liked. Can you talk about the two or three that you feel like are definitely worth the monthly fee?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, you know, I was looking at our app last night too. And so I like Shopify apps that directly increase revenue. So I think a lot of people are afraid of like putting too many upsells and pop-ups and add this, add that into their Shopify flow. But I'm not scared to do that at all. I literally throw it everywhere I can. I have a spot for it. So one of the ones I really like is Frequently Bought Together by Code Black Belt. I think it's like $7 a month. We've generated about 17,000 through that app. And then there's another one I like called In-Cart Upsell. So, you know, when someone hit the button, go to cart, there's like a little snippet at the bottom that tells them, hey, why don't you buy a little oil for your cutting board or some kind of creative? And we've generated about 35,000 through that app. And then, you know, we have other things too, like a pop-up when you hit the add to cart button, I'm trying to upsell them on something or cross-sell them on something. And then if they didn't do any of that, once they get to checkout, I try to upsell them again at checkout. And then if they didn't do anything there, I try to get them again with the app Reconvert, which I really love. So that's Reconvert by, I forgot who does it. It's called Reconvert by Stilio Apps. So we've generated about $3,500 through there. So, you know, a lot of these numbers aren't giant, but they all really add up.
Well, guys, congratulations on a great purchase and acquisition and transformation of the business over the last 10 years. And one thing I want to ask you about too, it's totally unrelated, but you know, we're talking right now, you guys are down in Florida, and we're talking a little bit about how you guys, you love travel, and that's a big part of your, you know, why you guys do what you do and why you design your business around being able to do that. And I'd love to hear kind of in just closing, like how, what, if there's any, I guess, first and foremost, how often you get out, where you like to go, but maybe even more relevant as well is how do you structure your business in a way that lets you get out and travel and be able to do a lot of this stuff? Because you guys are obviously doing some very cool things on the business side, but you're also able to get out and adventure a lot too, which I think is very cool. So I'd love to hear kind of just how you intentionally structure your business and lives to make that happen.
So when we really started getting into e-commerce, it was for the one goal of creating some more freedom in our life and being able to do the traveling and just kind of live on our own terms. Both of us come from similar backgrounds, so we're both actually pharmacists. So we've had jobs we're kind of tied to for certain lengths of time. I had been in and out of pharmacy over the years. I had some brick and mortar businesses, but those also tied me down. So where I was, you know, pretty much working what felt like 24 hours a day. And both of us had kind of had the same vision of, you know, like Janine says all the time, like, doesn't everybody want a laptop lifestyle? and we really did. And we just worked hard, you know, continuously towards this goal and then creating a business that still allowed us to have a great lifestyle. So we're kind of reluctant in taking on things that require too much of our time. Mm-hmm. Even though in the past year we have taken on some stuff that did take a lot, but we can still do it from anywhere.
Yeah, and we'll outsource those pretty soon.
Right.
Are there any decisions you can look back on where you intentionally made, you said no or yes, completely based on this kind of, you know, the framework of, hey, this is gonna make it harder for us to do what we want to do? Like what are some of the things that you declined or didn't do because you thought it would just make this too hard?
I think one of the things was when we finally made the decision to sell our other brand, it started getting to the point where we felt like in order to, so we were very close to about $5 million in revenue at that point. Our inventory purchases started being, you know, $200,000 at a pop. We started taking on financing and we started feeling like in order to kind of take this business to the next level, it's going to require more than just us two. It's going to require some more funding. So it started getting us a little bit out of our comfort zone. And we felt that we're putting ourselves more at risk, taking on either employees or outsourcing a lot of stuff. And we kind of felt that it was, the money was great, but it was starting to kind of steal what we had kind of tried to build, which was freedom, less stress. And as the numbers started getting bigger and bigger, it was more stress. And we felt definitely very highly leveraged in that business. So I think that knowing that we wanted a lifestyle the way we have it, so that kind of was a big reason of why we sold that one. And that just opened up a whole ton more freedom.
Well, Agatha, I'd love to end on a lightning round here, if you're up for it. So just rapid fire kind of answers to these, and we can alternate with you if you're cool with that. And Janine, maybe we can start with you. I may know the answer to this question already, but favorite piece of e-commerce tech?
Yeah, definitely. Klaviyo email.
Klaviyo, great. Next question is least favorite piece of e-commerce tech? And we'll alternate here.
This is a tough one, and it's for a different brand we have, but it's a love-hate relationship right now with Recharge.
Recharge, what's the 30-second love-hate version of it?
So I guess they're definitely the leader in the recurring revenue subscription-based platform, but there's a lot of things that we want to do that it just isn't allowing us to. And a lot of it has to do around like prepaids and gifting, that we have great ideas that we just can't do on a technical basis with it. But it does seem to be improving.
Janine, what's one of your fondest memories from your childhood?
I thought I know the answer to that. Now I can't think of anything. Oh, you know what? When I was between the ages of 10 to 13, my mom and my sisters would always take us to the local beach, and we would play jump rope there with me, my mom, and my sisters.
Nice. Brian, what's your favorite item you sell on the website? And we'll link up to it.
Yeah, definitely our giant, extra large walnut wood cutting board.
Very cool. Janine, you're getting all the heavy, the serious, deep ones here, Janine. What was a major seminal moment or period in your life?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, it's when we sold our brand. It's that excitement, sigh of relief, and it just really changed our lives, the moment we sold the brand.
Yeah. What was the biggest thing that it changed in your life? Like in terms, was it a stress or maybe the doing something different with some of the proceeds that you hadn't before? What was the biggest change in your life as a result of that sale?
I think it was the kind of the comfort of being in a really good financial position. And it also happened with us at probably it couldn't have happened at a better time. So I think literally a day or two before the stock market crashed due to this whole COVID thing, it was when we got the money deposited into our bank account.
Wow. So it has really threaded the needle on that one.
So it was amazing. And it allowed us to invest at that time. So yeah, we were able to do really well in the stock market because of it. And timing was just incredible.
Wow. Well played. That's impressive. And then last question for you, Brian, who's the most interesting person you've met as being a part of the ECF private community?
Yeah, so pretty new. So we haven't had a ton of exposure to people, but we did hook up with a few. And Riyadh with potatoparcel.com, super interesting business. Got on a phone call for maybe an hour or so one night.
Yep, and the just last time we were in Florida.
Yeah, so kind of just shared each other's stories. He's kind of looking to follow the same path of exiting pretty soon. So super interesting website if you haven't checked it out.
Yeah, no, it's very, very cool. He's a great guy. Well, Brian, Janine, thank you. Congrats on again, the acquisition. And you guys obviously are super savvy operators in what you've done with it. Make sure you check out virginiaboyskitchen.com. You can look at all the beautiful, beautiful cutting boards and products and knives that they have. Like, of course, like they said, all made in the USA. I could see these being fantastic gift items or just spicing up and kind of upgrading your own kitchen. So really appreciate you guys being part of the community and being willing to come share and talk about the journey on the podcast. It's impressive what you guys have done. And it was fun to be able to just interrogate you for an hour about how you did it. So thank you for being willing to do it and best of luck with the brand going forward.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much for listening. And the fact that you made it to the end of the episode tells me you're probably someone interested in this stuff and might be a really good fit for the e-commerce fuel community. Our community is the world's largest group of 7- and 8-figure e-commerce store owners and offers a value-packed form, dynamic live events, and much more. If that sounds interesting at all, you should learn about membership and how to apply at ecommercefuel.com. Big thank you to our two sponsors. Supercharge your email marketing efforts with Klaviyo, the world's best email and SMS marketing engine at klaviyo.com/ECF. And also one-click upsell from Zipify apps, where you can rapidly increase your average order value by offering powerful targeted upsells. You can get started with them at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. Finally, thanks to Sherelle Torricampo for helping produce the show. Work hard, adventure often. I'm looking forward to seeing you again next Friday.
This is the ASY Radio Network live from New York.